Blog Talk Radio.
This is Rare Bird Radio. I'm Mary Tabor, author of the novel Who by Fire, and with me today is the man about town, the globe-trotting journalist, Michael Johnson. Michael Johnson was a career editor at McGraw-Hill. He spent years in Moscow as a correspondent for the Associated Press. He writes for the New York Times, the International Herald Tribune, the American Spectator, the Boston Musical Intelligencer, the Columnist.com, Regular Eye on Europe. I don't know where to go from here. He's lived in Paris and in Bordeaux for 15 years, and he's my guest. Hi, Michael.
Greetings from Boston. It's a pleasure to be here, Mary.
Oh, I'm so glad to have you. How are you today?
Well, I couldn't be better. The sunshine is streaming in the window. I have my travel schedule organized, so I'll get out of here before the snow comes, and I'll be back in Bordeaux, and you won't be.
That's for sure. I wish I were coming along. One of the things, before we talk about your views on re-entering American life from France, on which you recently did a fascinating piece, let's talk about your review of Joe Harris's new book. You did this for the American Spectator, and Joseph Harris has written a book called An American Spectator in Paris, and you say, and I want you to tell me about what this means, Harris comes closest to any writer I know to nailing French jello to the wall.
Well, I hesitated before using that wonderful phrase because I'm afraid it's a little bit of a cliche, but it seemed to fit so well because it gives you a good image of how hard it is to get to grips with something. And if you're talking about French character and French culture and French society and the French as a people, it's very hard to get them into a box. It's very hard to hold them still so you can look. They're always moving. They're always changing their mind. They're always surprising you. You don't know where they're coming from. And that's, of course, the secret of their success, too. They are absolutely fascinating, and we all love to study them and try to figure them out. And that's what Joe Harris does so well.
Does he skewer them at all?
Pardon?
Does he skewer them at all, you know? Poke at them? Does he give them a hard time? We always want the tough stuff.
Skewer is a bit harsh for what Joe does. He's a consummate reporter and actually has spent 50 years in Paris writing about the French, and has a French wife, and he loves the place. He has you might say mixed feelings about his life because he is the odd man out in his social circle. He's the foreigner. Of course, on the other hand, he doesn't pull his punches. When he talks about Dominique Strauss-Kahn, he is horrified about what happened to the former director of the International
Right.
Monetary Fund. And that story continues to roll on and on, as you know. If he
Right,
talks about
the
French unhappiness about their reduced role in the world, he doesn't thumb his nose. He states the fact that this is hard for them to accept. And, in fact, that accounts for some of their hostile attitudes toward the United States because the U.S., in a sense, replaced France as a global power. If you look back to the First World War and ensuing wars and conflicts and events. So we Americans, and by the way, I'll explain in a minute, I'm not a typical American, but I do call myself an American for these purposes. We not only became powerful, but we also prospered. And almost at the same time, in tandem, the French lost power and became less prosperous. So they're struggling with this paradox now and are not at all happy about it, and sometimes they take it out on us. I must say, sometimes we take it out on them, too.
Mike, it's a really great view. It's a really great review. I think Joseph Harris is lucky to have you as a writer in his corner. And you also have just re-entered the United States. And I think that you did kind of take a little kebab and skewer the U.S. a little bit in the article you did on forthecolumnist.com. And I would like to ask you this question instead of about the article. I'd like to ask you if you think that we Americans are being dumbed down by our TV sets.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
How so?
I sit here in the Boston suburbs on quiet evenings sometimes and flip through, I don't know, 300 or 400 cable channels, sometimes just out of curiosity. And if I'm lucky, I might find CNN at a moment when they don't have some of their more repulsive characters reading the news, and I can watch something there.
You want to name names? You want to name names, Michael?
Yes.
Go ahead.
I'd be delighted. And they are both characters with two last names, so I get some satisfaction out of inverting them. I'm, of course, talking about Cooper Anderson and Morgan Pierce. Please. Get these guys off the air.
Their names, of course, yes.
Yes. Yes, there's no question that Americans are reading less, thinking less, exercising their minds less. They're becoming more and more passive. This is not today's news, of course, but it continues in the wrong direction, and I don't see any solution for it. And of course, not everybody's like that. There are pockets of thinking people, and here in Brookline, where I am at the moment, there's a marvelous independent bookstore, and if you're of a mind,
that's
you can strike up a conversation with a like-minded person. No problem there. Somebody who actually reads books.
Well, they might even be
reading Who by Fire.
Oh, well, thank you. That's what comes out soon. So thank you for mentioning it. I've got wonderful things that you've said about that book, and I'm so grateful for it. I'd like to talk about how we actually got to talking to one another. We've never really met, and this is our first time really ever to talk to one another. And we came together through an article you'd written about Nabokov, whom I just adore. And
Go ahead.
No, you go.
Well,
you go ahead.
I also adore him. So there, it was predestined that we would come together around old Vladimir. Yes, absolutely. I can't get enough of him, and I like not only reading his stuff, but I like reading what others are writing about him. And you know who I'm referring to, of course.
Yes,
Brian
you're referring
Boyd,
to who, Brian Boyd.
Right.
Yes.
Brian Boyd did the marvelous two-volume biography of Nabokov, also without meeting him, by the way. But, of course, he spent a lot of time with Nabokov's widow, Vera, and his son, Dmitri. Both of whom have since expired. But he wrote these magisterial two volumes, and then followed it up with a third volume of what you might say were outtakes, that is, things that were left over, things that he had done about Nabokov since.
And I love
since
the title,
famous
Stalking Nabokov, isn't it? Do I have that right?
Stalking, yes, that was a beautiful title. And
yeah,
so
I feel
interesting.
Like I'm stalking, I feel as if I'm stalking you, Michael. Sometimes I feel that way following you around on the web with every article you're writing in one place and the other. You have an article in the New York Times on Pushkin. But before we get to him, I'd like to talk about art for a little bit because I think you're really interested in art. It's one of the reasons I think you did take on American television and a lot of American habits in the article you did for thecolumnist.com. And I'd like to give you a favorite quote of mine. It's by someone you may or may not know. His name is William Gass. William Gass is essayist, philosopher. I love his work. And he says, "Works of art confront us the way few people dare to, completely, openly, at once." Do you agree?
Beautiful, beautiful. Well, I don't put myself in that class. Although the principles I operate by are pretty much the same. What's the point of writing if you're not going to write what you exactly feel and think? I mean, I'm not a PR man. I'm a writer, and I think people expect writers to open their minds and let it all flow out. And sometimes
did you ever dance around a little with PR? It sounds like there's something in that history there. Is there?
I didn't quite get that. What about PR?
Did you dance around a little with PR? Did you take PR on as a partner at some point in your life in this long career?
I was hoping you wouldn't bring that up. But,
good. Let's talk about it then.
There was a period, I don't mind saying, well, the period when I left McGraw-Hill that I decided to create my own communications consultancy, I grandly called it. In fact, I called it Competitive Communications.
Really?
And the reason I chose that is I came to the conclusion that people who communicate well are those who will do well in life. And the reverse is also true. People who can't communicate are going to be stumbling along to the very end. So if you are persuasive in the way you use the language, you're going to make things happen. And if you can't do it, somebody else will step on you and make it happen their way. So my consultancy was Competitive Communications, and it included everything from media training, you know, helping tongue-tied executives get ready to face somebody from the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, and all the way through to helping these guys and gals learn to write the English language.
So, Michael, would you have advice for a struggling writer with a novel coming out, two additional books, you know? Would you have advice on how I could communicate better or do a little better? Could you give me a little PR advice even though you gave up on that? Got any words of wisdom for me here?
Well, first of all, don't be shy. Get out there and shout from the rooftops how great you are, and make sure people are listening. Although I'm sure you know as well as anyone that in this media-frenzied society we now have created for ourselves, the competition is horrendous to get the attention of someone who actually owns a printing press or owns a broadcast outfit. But I see you're doing quite well. Look at you today. Who would have thought?
Well, who knows? Who knows? I guess we'll see. You're also quite the polyglot, aren't you? How many languages do you speak?
Well, only three. I mean, if you count English.
All?
Well, I speak Hoosier also, because I actually was born and raised in Indiana. That's sort of a separate language. Yes, I studied Russian in college and French in college, and I still use them both all the time. Believe it or not, I had my car repaired the other day, and the guy who owns the garage is a Russian. So
wow,
we had a grand
time.
That
had to be really
Pardon?
Fun. And also, you've recently been to Brussels and spoken with some relatives of Pushkin, haven't you?
That was an unforgettable day, Mary.
Tell us about it.
Well, the thinning genes syndrome in the families of great men and women is well known. It's very rare that the children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren come anywhere near the progenitor. I think a couple of the Tolstoys did well, but none of the Pushkins did. So this fellow, the great-grandson, worked for ITT in Brussels for about 25 years, selling telecommunications equipment. And when you contrast that to where he came from, ultimately back to Alexander Pushkin, the same name, by the way, so they're both, it's kind of eerie to talk to someone called Alexander Pushkin. I wouldn't call it sad, it's life, you know. And he is, of course, a huge admirer of his great-grandfather. He has the books, he has drawings and portraits of him around the house. I was a little disappointed that when he served me tea, it wasn't in a glass, the way the Russians do it.
That's the way my grandparents had tea, and they were they were Russian Jews. That's the way they had tea. Tea in a glass, you know, little piece of sugar in the bottom. Yeah, you sip the tea through the sip the tea through the sugar between your teeth. Did Nabokov bring you to Pushkin, or did Pushkin bring you to Nabokov?
Let me just take a second here and try to recall. It was definitely Nabokov who took me to Pushkin, because I got very interested in his brawl, I think is the word, with Edmund Bunny Wilson in the 1960s.
Tell us for those who don't know who Edmund Bunny Wilson is, because he's a very famous man. Not everybody listening might know.
It's a sad fact, isn't it, that somebody as great as Edmund Wilson is virtually unknown to anyone under about 40 years of age. But
well,
he was
Pushkin, too, in the U.S. We'll come back to that. But Pushkin, too, in the U.S.
Yeah.
So tell us who
sadder.
Edmund Wilson is, and then we want to hear about the brawl.
Okay, well, Edmund Wilson was the premier critic, critic of literature, writing of all kinds, poetry, etc., and no mean writer himself, associated with the New Yorker in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, and 60s. And he also was quite a linguist and fancied himself a competent Russian speaker, and even did a bit of translation of Russian poetry. And he sort of mentored Vladimir Nabokov in the initial years when Nabokov came over from Europe to take a job at Wellesley College.
Yes,
and,
where his wife taught most of the classes, by the way. Did you know that?
Yes.
Did you know that Vera taught most of the classes while he was at Wellesley?
So he was he owed a great debt to Edmund Wilson, and they were fast friends. I mean, really good friends. I've read their correspondence. There's a marvelous book. Of course, you have to find it on the used book sites now. It's long out of print, but it's called Dear Bunny, Dear Volodya. Volodya is a diminutive, familiar form of Vladimir in Russian, and that's how they addressed each other. Dear Bunny, Dear Volodya, and they're about as close as two men could be without being gay. And believe me, they were not gay. sadly, I believe it was 1962, they disagreed over recent translations of Pushkin's main oeuvre, which is Eugene Onegin. And they traded insults in the pages of the New York Review of Books for three or four issues in that era. And then the feud went on into a long, long piece that appeared in Encounter magazine. And that's
because he didn't think that Bunny was translating improperly, or was
Bunny,
the problem?
What exactly happened was Bunny took the side of Walter Arndt, A-R-N-D-T, who was a professor of Slavic literature and had done his own translation of Eugene Onegin. Nabokov hated the Arndt translation, considered it artless, riven with errors of actual words that Arndt hadn't grasped. Russian's a really complicated, multi-layered language, and if you didn't have a mother or a grandfather or a grandmother who spoke it to you as a child, you'll always be a foreigner in Russian. And Walter Arndt was of German extraction, so Nabokov seized upon this.
Michael, if I can interrupt, why do you think that I should say it Nabokov instead of Nabokov? I should think you're the one who speaks Russian. Nabokov.
It's Nabokov, right, actually.
Nabokov.
In Russian,
Nabokov.
The accent is on a kof.
Okay, Nabokov.
Nabokov.
Okay. So why do you think if we mention his name, people are going to know? Is that because of Lolita? Whereas if we mention Pushkin,
yes,
everybody knows who we're talking about.
Isn't that amazing? Lolita is the book that made him wealthy, but he actually wrote 7 or 8 marvelous novels besides that one, and wasn't even particularly happy with Lolita, and in fact had a terrible time getting it published, because in the late 50s, when it came out, there was a still a very prudish set of legal mechanisms that stopped such works from getting into the hands of pure-minded Americans. So he had a terrible time and finally published it with a Paris house that specialized in, you'd call it mild pornography, Henry Miller and some things even worse. So
that Lolita even falls in that category. And in fact, it on my copy it says the best love story ever written on the front of my copy. And I tend to agree. And I also think that this is a book that's really about the love of children and not at all the way it's perceived as a book about pederasty. I think it's a really beautiful, beautiful book, and I tend to carry it in my pocket for that reason and reread it and reread it. I also love a lot of his other work, particularly the memoir, Speak Memory, and Ada. How would you say that? How would you pronounce that one? Would that be Ada? Would that be correct in the pronunciation of that great book?
Sorry, I didn't quite hear which book you referred to.
His novel.
Oh, Ada. Yes, Ada.
Yeah.
Absolutely, not Ada. And he
right.
that was a great trampoline for his famous wordplay. He tossed Ada up and as a juggler would, turned it inside out and had fun with Ada. Yes, he was. McGraw-Hill was publishing him when I was with McGraw-Hill, and
I
knew the gal who was editing him very well. Beverly Liu recently died as well. But unfortunately, I never had the pleasure of crossing paths with him. He was in and out of the building a few times, but not in my, not when I was looking. So I sort of brushed near him now and then, but it was really the 1962 feud with Edmund Wilson that got me interested in Pushkin.
Yeah,
of course,
Pushkin was both prolific. I think you've said this. I think I'm quoting you here that he was prolific, subversive, and fun. I think that describes you. Could I be right about that?
Well, maybe that's why I like him so much.
He was a bit of a rake, wasn't he? Are you a bit of a rake, Michael?
Well, I have to say I haven't had nearly as much fun in life as he did. He had at least 2 children out of wedlock and 4 more with his wife, and he was busy with almost anything in a skirt in the interim. So he was known as a brilliant, brilliant writer. By the way, he was the first Russian writer to make his living from writing. All the others were diplomats or aristocrats living off their father's or grandfather's money. But he was—he didn't have any money. His only income was from what he could sell to magazines and what he could get published on his own.
I know you're doing some work on him because of the articles that I've been seeing floating around, including the one that appeared in the New York Times, and I know you're probably going to do something more on him. I also know that you somehow go by the name of Voltaire, because the time that I found you, I wrote a comment on the article that you wrote, and you apparently identify yourself as Voltaire. Have you got something going with Voltaire? And should we somehow be discussing what's that great line from Voltaire? The best of all possible worlds. Are we in the best of all possible worlds, Michael Johnson?
Absolutely not. That was a joke that came out of Candide, and it kind of stuck in the human consciousness. I use Voltaire sometimes when I'm responding online to commenting, say, on some writing that others have done. I'm not hiding. I mean, people who know me know that I play around with this name. In fact, one of my email addresses is Zozo.Arue. Well, Voltaire's real family name was Arue, and Zozo was his childhood nickname. And
wow.
You have to be deep into Voltaire to get that one, but...
I bet.
I do love his work. And in fact, I'm writing a one-man show that I hope to get produced based entirely on Voltaire's actual writings. And they are hilarious and also deep. And I'm trying to show it will be somewhat similar to the Mark Twain one-man show that ran for years and years with... what's his name? The actor. Help me, Harry. You know who I mean, don't you?
anyway, I do, but I can't come up with his name at the moment. I hope someone does, but we'll add it later. I'll put it on somewhere on my blog. But I know exactly who you mean.
He's,
so we're just gonna have to go with we're trying to remember.
I know his story very well because he wrote a book about how he came to portray Mark Twain and how he personally, the actor, did all the research and wrote the script. That's pretty unusual.
Before we leave Nabokov and as we come sort of to the close of this show, because I think we've come kind of full circle in a way, I'd like to bring you back to your love of words. And I know one of the words you love is nebibulous. Omnibibulous. So, and that word, was Pushkin and Nabokov, were they omnibibulous?
Ambibulous.
Ambibulous, is that how you say it? Ambibulous, okay, ambibulous.
Ambibulous. It simply means somebody who is willing to drink anything,
uh-huh.
drink everything, I should say.
Uh-huh.
So if you break it down into its Latin pieces, you can see where it comes from. And I actually borrowed that from H.L. Mencken, who was one of my earlier heroes as I was developing as a wordsmith myself. And,
let me say this to you. First of all, it was Hal Holbrook. Okay.
Oh, very good.
So who played Mark Twain.
What are you doing,
secondly,
Googling on the side?
No, I'm not. Just came to me. the brain works in strange ways. You are someone I would love to have a glass of wine with, and I'd like to close this show this way because this has been a wonderful talk, Michael Johnson, the bon vivant, the man about town, the man about the world. And I'd like to close, as Nabokov might say, in the low hum of harmony. Michael Johnson, we've connected. Thank you so much for a fabulous show.
Well, it's been marvelous from my side, too. I really appreciate it. And let's do it again sometime.
Let's
We just
do
scratched
it again.
The surface, you know.
Yes, you bet.
Okay, Mary, it's been wonderful.
Thank you. Goodbye, sir.
Bye-bye for now.
Bye-bye.
Left you on the debris at the Sunday morning market. You were starting through the odds and ends. You was looking for a bargain. I heard your footsteps at the front door. You knew you'd find me waiting there at the top of the stairs. I went there and back. The devil with the General Workers Union, and yet that they'll never change a thing. Well, they won't fight, and they're not working. Left you on the debris. Now we both know you got the money, and I wonder what you would have done without me.